We had a collaboration with some Chinese scientists.
Here we have a vaccine. What is the problem? Get over it.
Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%.
I hope that it can occur in a civil way. I mean civil in a special way, peaceful.
The biggest question, maybe in economics and politics of the coming decade, will be what to do with all these useless people.
I just see the need for such a dialogue, and I see the need for action. I see the need for a great reset.
We are 216 weeks into 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Johnny Emerson alongside Melissa. Melissa, how are you?
I am good. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I shouldn't say that because I didn't get much sleep last night. I had one of those. You ever have those nights where you just can't sleep? You just like you're all bug eyed. You're tired, but you just lay down and you're like, I can't sleep, and you just keep flipping and flopping and doing all kinds of stuff, and nothing works.
Yeah, I've had a few of those, sadly.
Yeah, so that's.
I recommend Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope.
It just so happens I have a copy right here, literally at arm's length.
It's an excellent sleeping pill.
Not really. Okay, some parts of it are long-winded, yes. I remember when I was reading some chapters, I'm just like, okay, just get on with it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in my honest opinion, as masterfully done as the book is, I don't like how do you quantify everything that was in that book in as little pages as he did? I think he could have made it twice as large or done a second volume.
That is true. That really is true. And truthfully, it isn't boring, really.
No, absolutely.
You know, it's just that when you pick up a section that he wants to talk about names, dates, and it goes on and on for pages, and you know that you won't retain it. That's a good way to go to sleep, but yeah.
It is a mark, though, of a good historian. He was a macro historian. So, I mean, it is a mark of a good historian to put, like, dates and everything else in with all your references. So
that's, oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's how it is. But anyway, on to the topics, I guess, of the day. Where would you like to start? What's been front and center for you over the last couple of weeks? And then we'll branch off from there. We were talking about a few things in Soundcheck, and we can get into all that again. I'm happy to, because there's no shortage of discussion there.
I think I thought a little bit about the video that you sent me that was based on some things that Alan Watt had said. I have also been thinking about World War I. Because that's where I am, and Tragedy and Hope and the Versailles Treaty, and pulling together other things that I have read in the last year. Like I read a biography of Bernard Baruch that was the Wall Street speculator kind of involved in World War I and the Paris Conference and social degradation. And how I think one of the things that popped into my mind so strongly and thinking about World War I and all of the changes that came out of it, such a tremendous loss of life. It's just terrible. But there is that place that Alan liked to reference in Tragedy and Hope, where Quigley says, now this is Alan's paraphrase. I actually found the exact quote, but basically you get more done in 5 years of war than 20 or 30 years of peacetime or a generation of peacetime culturally. And it made me think about the last, since the beginning of 2020, what we've lived through. And I am of the mind that the world is completely different now than it was in 2019. And it's irrevocable. We will not go back to that in any way. We're moving into the fourth industrial revolution. And, you know, this great reset has happened and is happening. And so a huge wartime changes. And there's something else. Sorry, you better interrupt me because I'm just going to start babbling.
No, it's okay. No, it's all right. I have that audio, and I would like to add it to this discussion because I think it hit all those marks of the changing of the culture that we've seen since the 1920s, which, you know, First World War. And I do remember, as soon as you mentioned that that chapter in Tragedy and Hope, I do remember the staggering numbers in there. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall ever hearing about those types of losses that we took, you know, in all countries, not just the U.S. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember hearing about any of those death numbers in any of my mainline education. And that's that in itself is a tragedy to not know that.
You have to put it together from, if you're paying attention and you're interested, you really have to pull that together in your mind from a variety of sources. At one of the things, there was a wartime kind of one of those fun documentaries where they reenact things. And it was Wartime Farm. I think it might have been a BBC production, Wartime Farm. And it's preparing for World War II. But they bring up the idea that there simply were not enough men to farm. And the reason why there weren't enough men is because a whole generation had been wiped out just 20 years prior at World War I. Such a staggering loss of life. It's really hard to wrap your head around.
It is. And I specifically remember that line from Tragedy and Hope when Quigley said in that book, he said, the amount of losses, I'm kind of paraphrasing because I can't quite remember off the top of my head without pulling the book for reference, but he said that the amount of, the loss of life is incalculable even by today's standards. Mm-hmm. And I think that rings true even to today. I mean, that book was written in the 60s. I mean, now it's, you could put that same statement to now.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the way our culture is managed for us is they just keep moving us along from one crisis to the next crisis. And we're so caught up in the relatively short span of our own lives and everything that we need to accomplish personally in our own lives that it's hard to step back and take that big picture look at just what happened. But another thing too, I really wanted to pull this up both for the book club chat and if we touched on it here, but another little documentary type thing that I saw in Great Britain, this was put out years ago. I cannot tell you when they finally managed to pay off their World War I debt, but it's pretty fascinating. In other words, it seems to me that it just happened. I mean, it was very recent.
I don't know about the World War I. I think it was, I think Marty was bringing it up, the World War II debt that they had to the U.S. They just paid that off. I think it was in 2016, 2017, something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. It was staggering. I mean, this was a really good visual that was done. It's one of those, you know, little educational videos that you got a lot of in, say, the late 50s.
Yeah.
But loss of life, the debt incurred, nothing is ever for the benefit of the common Joe, the common G.I. Joe.
Well, let's see what the benefit of the culture is. Let's play this clip from Alan. Now, this is about 8 minutes long, but I think it's worth the entire 8 minutes. Would you agree?
It is worth the entire 8 minutes. And I'm going to say something else, too. I always just take your audio of the podcast and then put it up on the different sites and channels because I've got so much going on. But with this one, I'm going to make an exception and plug in the video that someone created. What was that? Your Wisdom. It's a channel on YouTube.
Yeah, Your Evolving Wisdom or My Evolving Wisdom. There's two.
Yeah. He's got them both ways, but it does an excellent job on the video.
And here it is.
About 100 years ago, this big organization with many branches, they wanted to rule the world basically using Britain as a nucleus of a system, an embryo, which also was going to be joined with the U.S. under the Anglo-American establishment, wrote about the kind of culture and the changes of culture over a 100-year period that they would actually design. We're all tribal to an extent. That's why we even bother to vote for a tribal leader. This is well understood. That's why we're supplied with these leaders. And because the average man was to become more disengaged from his own destiny, as the expert class arose, it was decided that, the males would get their outlet, basically, gradually becoming helpless as the males, through sports. Therefore, they'd have a tribal team they could identify with. They could cheer them on as they were winning. In their own personal lives, they were getting nowhere. They were getting disenfranchised, in a sense, as experts took over decision-making for them in all kinds of fields. So this was psychology at use, planned before they even implemented the sports. When radio came along, of course, they used that to the maximum, sports for the men, soaps basically for the women, and then in came television with its alpha state, its hypnotic state, and men became glued to the sports shows. As I say, since the 1960s, once television really, really took off, sports used to only come out on Saturdays. And over a 10-year period, it gradually came on every night of the week. Until today, we have even sports channels, sports, sports, sports. And now you see guys who are sitting home, who are basically powerless at work, they have bosses, they're powerless on the roads, there's police and traffic wardens and cops watching them. They have no means to feel strong. And so they tend to watch sports as a substitute. They project themselves into a game which they never participate in. But as long as their team wins, they feel something's happening in their life that's positive and it's successful. It's a very good substitute for many, many things as far as the elite are concerned. The intention being ultimately to alter society, drastically alter it so much that even the purpose, for instance, of marriage would lose any appeal. People don't realize they brought in the miniskirt back in the 1920s during Prohibition. They brought in cocaine at the same time as well, along with the booze, to get young people in. The idea being if you're doing something illegal, it's very naughty. Youngsters love to break the rules, get together, we're all being naughty together. And sex and booze, you know, coupled with coke being smuggled in at that time, had its desired effects. So they came out, as they say, with not sex and rock and roll, but sex in a form of jazz. The Charleston dance came in, the miniskirt came in, sex became rather rampant for the first time. All the old traditional taboos were broken with one generation, but there was fallout to this change, this massive change in culture. The fallout being that they did not have the antibiotics to treat all the sexually transmitted disease that came along. Secondly, they didn't have the legal abortion clinics to take care of the unwanted children that also were produced by hyper-promiscuity. They opened up big orphanages to try and take care of this, the boys' towns that had once for girls too. But there was so much backlash, especially in the United States, from the old Christian communities, that they had to tone it all down. It kind of flopped. Sexually transmitted disease became rampant. So did unwanted pregnancies and abortions. And so they went back to the drawing board, because remember, before this all happened, the big players, the new high priesthood, we'll call them, of the Time Lords, those who create the future, work in think tanks for the big establishment, had a definite mandate. The only problem was how do you achieve that mandate over a time period. And they've always known, for instance, in wartime, more children are produced because people, young people who might go off to die tomorrow tend to be far more promiscuous. They brought this back after World War II, big time, and worked on it steadily. All our tax money went into one particular area of research, not just for the atomic weaponry and so on. It went into finding ways of finding a contraceptive that was effective. When they found it and launched it on the scene, at the same time as it launched what they called pop music, along with drugs, LSD and so on, they brought the contraceptive. So then permission was given, in a sense, and promoted from the top down, even from the BBC, which is, remember, the BBC is owned by the British government. It's an arm of the British government. It talks on behalf of the dominant minority who rule Britain. So they began to promote all this stuff. All the DJs they'd bring on television would interview top pop stars of the day. They were all stoned out of their minds. Some of them were falling out of chairs. And the interviewers would say, "Tee hee, aren't we naughty children?" All aimed at a young generation to emulate. This is what we do. Monkey see, monkey do. Once again, remember, the prime intent was to break the old culture of boy meets girl, going together for a while, getting engaged, getting married, having children. The family unit, it said, when we had the League of Nations, which was the precursor of the United Nations, said they'd have to destroy the family unit. Pretty well all of H.G. Wells's non-fiction books promotes all of this agenda. And in fact, he coined the term in the late 1800s. This is how far back this agenda for promiscuity had to go. He coined the term free love. And in one of his books written before 1890, he says, we must promote free love in order to destroy and end the obsolete family unit. Once that's done, he said, the family is no longer in the way when government comes for an individual. Each individual will be solely responsible to the government itself, and no family will stand up around them like a primitive tribe and defend them. At the same time, the foundations within the United States and Britain and elsewhere were funding what appeared to be far-left groups, communist groups. So much so, as I say, the Rees Commission went in to look into this from the 50s to find out why top capitalists who owned international corporations and banks, international banks, were putting up foundations to fund far-left groups. Well, we know now it was to literally destroy the old culture in order to bring in the new culture, the new society. So therefore, you have the proliferation of sexual activity. The fallout still came from unwanted pregnancies, far reduced than it had before because of contraception. But then came the lead of the feminist charge, again funded by the Rockefeller Foundation in the States, to spearhead and demonstrate and demand the rights for abortion. If they could get the public to devalue human life, and that's in the writings of Julian Huxley. He says, if we need society to devalue human life, he says, and take humanity off its pedestal as a supreme being on the planet, then, he said, we can bring in our controlled society with a workable population. Everything works within culture towards an agenda. And as Plato said so long ago, over 2,300 years ago, culture and cultural changes must be authorized from the top. If it's grassroots, truly grassroots, then it's outside of the elite's control, and ripple effects could occur, and it could spread anywhere. They couldn't control it, contain it anymore. Therefore, the major changes in culture, which Plato said came through drama and the emulation of actors, actresses, including fashions that they wore and the music they heard, had to be strictly regulated and authorized from the top. The whole science of this, which was always a science and understood by those in those businesses, was used to the maximum to literally drastically alter culture so radically in the 60s and 70s that they could never return to a past way of living.
And we are right at that point. Everything that he discussed in there, we've hit every single one of those marks, and we're now at the point where the family, the last vestiges of the family is being swept out, along with religion and everything else that kind of goes along with it, you know, foundations of religion, Christianity, and we're headed towards that controlled society with, I don't want to say Agenda 21, it's not called that anymore, but this great reset and fourth industrial revolution, Agenda 2050 and everything else, all run by a digital control grid. We're headed directly towards all of that at breakneck speed.
We absolutely are. And first, I want to say again that channel, My Evolving Wisdom, I was not familiar with them until you sent me that. And they did a beautiful job on the video. It's subtitled and it's just lovely to look at. Really good visuals. They have a few other things I noticed there too. A lot of Manly P. Hall he's illustrated and a few other Allens. I shouldn't say he. It could be a woman. I don't know. But whoever is doing the channel.
Gender's fluid now, isn't it?
So, that's right. But yes, we are exactly where Alan described that we were going, and that is where we are. And we see it all of the time. And I think, you know, I don't get to spend as much time reading news stories and looking into what is happening, but I do spend a fair bit of time illustrating talks. And so that puts me in with video footage and seeing what's going on. And one thing that I saw in the World War I video that I illustrated last night, when I was discussing with Jared from the book club chat, the fact that to me, it seemed that those more than, you know, what Quigley was talking about, all the changes that you can do in a wartime period, we had seen come into effect in the last few years. And he agreed. And sure enough, there I find just the common community grocery store somewhere in upstate New York, not a big city. To keep down theft, they're doing biometrics. This is just your neighborhood grocery store, yeah. And it's a disclaimer when you walk in of what biometrics might include. That might include your fingerprint. It might include an iris scan. And people are okay with that because they've been trained the fun way with their technology that if they want to get into their Apple phone, it might be easier to just do a face scan or an iris scan than to put a code in, to put a password in. So it is all here.
I remember we had reviewed video of someone walking into an Aldi grocery store. I believe it was in central London, and you could not get in. They had like the plastic, they aren't really like dividers. It's kind of like the turnstiles you have to walk through when mm-hmm. you go into like a subway or something. It mm-hmm. was that, but it was like these plexiglass, like plastic doors that would swing open and close. You couldn't, unless you jumped over top of them, you were not getting through. But you had to scan a QR code to get into the shop from your phone. You couldn't get in any other way. So it's full biometrics to get in. And I had mentioned that to you. And you know something? I still go. I went to a store to pick up some steak a few days ago, and they still have all these plastic dividers up. Like they haven't taken them down. They're still there.
Really?
Yeah. And I walked into and I started to see this after COVID, and I did talk about this, and I think we did discuss it on recording at the time. But I remember that after COVID, it wasn't even during COVID, it was after, they started putting in these metal bars, as in like walkways mm-hmm. that swing open when you go into supermarkets mm-hmm. now. They're not plastic or anything. These are metal. You know, these are bars that are designed to keep people out. Now you can walk through them because it's got a little proximity sensor on it and the door swings open. But all they have to do is add a QR code scanner to that and you're not getting in. I think that's for the next phase.
That's right. And it'll be QR for a while because that was heavily introduced during the last few years. But eventually it'll be determined that QR isn't secure enough and it'll have to be your iris scan. You know, it's just step by step. Another thing too that ties in with what Alan was outlining in that video is the continued march of sexual degradation and how that ramps up again in a wartime scenario. Now, what he's talking about there, that period of the mini skirt and the cocaine and all of that, is just post-World War I. That's when this happens. And if you think about it, I always like to give myself the visual that a woman's skirt in 1914 touched her ankles, and a woman's skirt in the fashionable thing that they were pushing in, say, 1927 barely covered her rear end. That is a period of, what, 13 years?
Yeah, it's one generation.
I mean, it's hard to take that in, but it is true. And another thing that we lived through in the last 4 years is what did people do during lockdown when a lot of people didn't have a job, the money that they got from the government wasn't adequate and so forth. It was the proliferation, the spread, the normalization, and the increase of sites like OnlyFans, I think is what it's called. Yep. The webcam, yep. You know, mm-hmm. it's a lot of people realized, well, if I set up a webcam and, you know, do whatever for whoever wants to watch that and subscribe, then I can make a living. And here, that takes you back to the Weimar Republic between World War I and, yeah.
It's digital prostitution is what it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's no other way to put it. I was talking to GP, one of our other guys here, who comes on, and hopefully we're gonna get him on next week because he's got himself a food truck now on the beach every day until 11 o'clock, where he does lunch and brunch, and then when he's done with that, he's a charter fishing boat captain. So he goes out and does charter fishing off the coast of
where
Florida.
Where is he? I'm sorry. I don't know where he's located. I haven't.
He's on the Gulf side of Florida. So he's on, I believe he said Pine Island is where he's at. So
he's
just over there. Yeah. So he was telling me about somebody that's, because it's, you know, an island. So everybody knows everybody kind of thing.
Right.
And he noticed one of the people that lives there, one of the young ladies that lives there. And he's like, you know, and he's from Los Angeles. So he can kind of tell when somebody's in the business, if you know what I mean, you know, what's, uh-huh. what kind of business is out there in LA. And he said, what do you do? You know, she's got all these cars and big house and everything. She said OnlyFans. I mean, we're talking millions here mm-hmm. is what this individual's clocking.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And this is what I've seen in, you know, illustrating talks and segments of Alan's stuff and so forth and looking. I try not to use too much of it because it's still shocking. You know, you'll push the envelope a little bit just to demonstrate where we are culturally and what's going on. But I also don't want to be, you know, contributing to that.
No, I don't want to contribute to it either. And here's something that is interesting about that particular I don't want to say profession. I don't call that a profession. I'm sorry. I just don't. But there is another podcast out there, and I'm not going to say which one it is because I'm not going to give them the credit to do this, because these people specifically, they say that they are a conservative podcast. Okay, so mm-hmm. I'm not gonna mention what it is, but they have these OnlyFans stars on all the time to interview them. They sit there and they are coming at it from a conservative standpoint, criticizing what they do, and there's dialogue back and forth about how one's wrong and the other one's right, and one's right and the other one's wrong. But at the end of it, they're plugging all of their OnlyFans websites so people can go to them.
Exactly.
Listen, crazy.
I don't know who you're talking about. I don't, you know, want to be around that world but I suspect that they are getting some kind of a commission for
plugging that's my those point. We're told as someone that opposes these mm-hmm. these viewpoints to go and watch these people and watch them be criticized, but at the mm-hmm. same time they're helping them get revenue from it.
Yeah.
Instead of actually just overall shaming this as a society and saying this is wrong, we're told to go and watch this medium and watch these people criticize these people. But oh, by the way, this is where you go find them.
It's sort of too, you don't even have to take a moralistic stance on this. You can just ask yourself the question, as people have been around pornography for generations now, what is going on economically, culturally, morally, in the society that people feel that this is the best choice that they can make for their lives? It makes me ask myself if we have already fully been in the Brave New World scenario where there is no longer any shame attached to this. I mean, has the bulk of society been so changed and altered that there is no stigma any longer? And that's possible. I still look at it with revulsion and horror, and it would just be shameful. I can't fathom it, but I wonder about the mindset of other people. It's like, it's no big deal, which is what Huxley was showing us in Brave New World. We're going to reach a point where it's not only no big deal, but if you're not doing it, and that's one of the things that he showed, promiscuity was required of you. It wasn't, you know, an available choice. It was required. And if you weren't promiscuous, you'd bring attention to yourself, like, why not? You know, the idea that you would want to mate and bond with one person. That's what Alan was talking about here. Because that kind of, see, it really isn't entirely a moral discussion here we're having. It's what keeps your society together and why. And he talks there about tribe. What is a tribe? And that's why people still vote. That's why they want a country intact and so forth. Because the original tribe is two people, man and woman. That's your tribe. Then you grow your tribe by having children. And then you're surrounded by people who have similar values. Say, if it's a clan system or Aboriginal tribe somewhere. That's tribe, and that's it comes from a natural place, which starts with the bonding and the act of mating between a man and a woman and what they're doing.
And you know, it's not just the end of marriage that's mixed up in all this. And I know we started out this segment talking about the OnlyFans thing, digital prostitution, slide down of things. But mm-hmm. I'm seeing this in other areas too. And it really got ramped up, as you said, during COVID, because everything went online at that point, didn't it? Mm-hmm. All the businesses, or most of the businesses, schooling and any kind of conferences, everything went online. Well, I've seen other things too. One of the big things out there, and Amazon actually got in on the ground of one of these things. A lot of things that people like to do, they like to stream video games. That's a big thing now, is doing all of that, or doing like they'll watch like movies with chat groups and things like that. They'll have like online presentations and stuff. I don't know. I think I mentioned this to you at one point in time. I'm seeing the revenue explode in these areas too, to a certain degree. And I cannot believe what I'm watching in this respect, not just from what we were talking about with the OnlyFans stuff, but this other stuff too. I saw one day, and I went through, and because Bruce was mentioning it to me, he's like, you got to go watch those, just see some of this stuff and watch what people are tuning into, because we want to see what is actually going on with the amount of viewership that people get in other areas as a different platform, a different form of content. And I turned this thing on one day. I turned this live stream on one day, and I saw this grown man. When I say a grown man, I'm talking late 30s, early 40s, okay? A grown man sitting there on a live stream for the internet, crying his eyes out, bawling his eyes out. And I could not I'm thinking, wow, I almost feel sorry for this guy as to how much this guy's just like breaking down in front of everybody on a live stream for, I think there were at least 200,000 people watching this at any given time. Yeah, yeah. And do you know why he was crying?
No. Idea, but I'm dying to know.
You're dying to know that. That's actually why he was crying, because his character in World of Warcraft died.
I shouldn't laugh, because it was obviously painful for him.
I can, and this is someone that is making millions of dollars, and I'm not joking. These are people that have multi-million dollar supercars parked in like loads of them, and houses and endorsements and everything else, and I'm like, how is that possible? Mm-hmm. That all of that means absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. It has no value to anything, and it has no intellectual value of any kind of content that you're putting to society.
You bring up a very important point there that JP is seeing with the woman in Florida and the man who's making millions of dollars and so forth. Is I don't believe that what we're seeing, that what's presented to us as how to make an incredible living and live in a virtual mansion with cars and all of that, I don't believe that that is possible for the average person. I think what we're seeing is very calculated and well-crafted, because I do know that they have agents and managers for so-called influencers. And they get deals and they get product placement. And so what we're seeing, it's the same way as back in the day when movies were the thing and television, because we're moving away from, you know, film and television. It's online, and the sports stars, and we'd see, or the rap musician or whatever, and be in the mansion and he's got a big party and all of the stuff and the bling and that. Well, that's not for everybody. You can't just be a good athlete and make that. You can't, you know, but what they're showing you is a lie, that anybody can get online and anybody can, you know, be an exhibitionist or do streaming of a video game and make a fortune. And that's not going to happen. It's very carefully managed and curated world where they're showing you a lifestyle that is impossible, because it is impossible. But what it does is it keeps your attention riveted. And so there'll be some poor, sad woman who's going to take endless photographs of her backside because, you know, some influencer with an agent has 100 million viewers and lives in a palace with three cars. And, you know what I mean? I mean, it's just, it isn't real. It isn't real. But what it does is it keeps people tuned into a very, well, as Alan would say, naughty, wink, wink, you know, naughty world where people do naughty things and they're richly rewarded. And that's where, that's what we've moved into. And this isn't, it's not just the most disgusting, degraded elements or the silly things like a grown man crying because his character is killed off. I've had countless conversations with a lot of people.
I'm sorry.
Who, I know, but they talk about all of the ways in which even older people like this man that you're pointing out, but women who they don't do anything except grow house plants. And then they document that in a very carefully, again, I say curated because it's like a museum or something. And you go through there and you see the house plants and supposedly she's making $100,000 a month off endorsements and product placement in her videos. And this is what we're getting over and over. And then you've got young people. Anybody under the age of 30 is being brought up in the influencer Instagram. Nothing is done because it's real. It's all done because it's a photo opportunity. And that's another thing. Alan did not talk about that in that video, but he talks about behavior changing because you modify or you add something to your environment. And the famous example that he gave was putting televisions in the home. And he talked about growing up in Scotland and going to the park and dozens of families would be out on a Sunday playing, the children playing and so forth. Then the televisions come into the community and night and day, nobody's in the park, nobody, because it changed the life that much. And also another thing that he talked about, which I think is worth remembering, is how much this ties in with biometrics and the CCTV everywhere. How does your behavior change when you know that you are being filmed, right? It changes drastically. And so we're in a culture now, like, for instance, you and I are looking at each other. It's not going up in a recording online, but we are looking at each other. So I might, if I was alone, want to reach back and scratch my back because it's been itching for 20 minutes, but because it looks awkward. Then
I don't care. Go ahead. It doesn't bother me. Because I'll do the same thing. I'll just scratch in the back of my head or something.
But you see what I'm saying. And so now you have a culture that for the last 20 years, everything is selfies and documenting it and putting it on Instagram and, you know, tweeting it out or whatever. And then how many likes do you get because, you know, your back end is more pert than, you know, I mean, it's it's very, it is, I laugh, but it's a tragedy.
It is. Yes, absolutely. It is different, though, to kind of just put a little bit finer of a point on it. It is a different thing when it, not just from being, because we, you know, we're not capturing the video, but just even to capture the audio, it takes a while to get used to that.
Yes.
When we first started, you can tell the difference from where we started to where we are now. And people really don't quite, if you don't do this, then people don't know how difficult this can be. It is very difficult because I've had people say to me before, multiple people, they've said, oh yeah, I'll do a podcast with you. And then they come on and then they just clam up. They just, they just completely shut down. They're like, sorry, I just can't do it. So, and then they're like, how do you sit there and do that for so long? And I'm like, I don't know. I just do it. So it is a different thing.
It is.
Switching gears a little bit. Let's go over to the, because in that clip, they were talking, or he was talking about grassroots, or grassroots movements being fake.
Yes,
and
yes.
You were saying in the in soundcheck that a lot of these things, one thing these are not is these are not grassroots, and that's the Palestinian Free Palestine movements that are happening across these university campuses, not just in the U.S., but Canada's got a whole bunch of them. The UK's got a bunch. Australia's now got them. And I'm not sure about here. I think they've got marches going on daily over here for that stuff anyway. But I was actually looking at where a lot of these groups are funded out of. And when we start going and tracing it back, it comes back to Soros money, of course. A lot of these groups that are tented up on these college campuses, New York University, I believe, was one of them. I was telling you that they had around 150 or so that were arrested over the past few days, and upwards of 80% of them, they're not even students of the university, and they're not even from the state. So they're just being bussed in from somewhere else. They show up, they've got food trucks that roll in, they've got all the tents and amenities and everything, all the sleeping arrangements and everything, all the protest gear and everything that they need, all the garb, the flags, the banners, everything. It's all just ready for them as soon as they step off the buses. That is not a grassroots movement.
No, it isn't. And the one thing that I said during the sound check preamble is that we've had conflict and major wars going on in that region for, you know, since your parents' parents' lifetime. And we didn't have this particular kind of response to it. What makes this different? And I'm sure that people will say, oh, there hasn't been so much Palestinian loss of life. And I agree that the loss of life of innocent women and children, it's terrible. But there is something very produced. And I mentioned, too, that you didn't have, I never saw a reaction when there was an anti-Israel sentiment going around or a pro-Palestinian sentiment. I didn't see, you know, some 18-year-old who was conversant in the Balfour Declaration and the history of that and where it came from. All of this is being fed to them for a reason which I don't know, but it's clearly not grassroots.
No, it is not. I like how you say produced. It's like, I'm thinking like Hollywood production at that point. Everything's
that's what it feels like. Yes, it does, that's what it feels like. You know, the whole thing so orchestrated, and I don't know. I don't even want to venture a guess as to why this, why now, but it's
I don't know. That's the thing. Why at this point? Why right now? Right now, to me, the timing doesn't seem right. You expect these things to pop up at some point, of course you do, or anything at a given time to distract you from something else. But there's I don't know what they need the distraction for right now. There's almost, maybe it's because there's nothing else going on that's pressing at the moment that they need a distraction for. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, there's so much we knew, I think, from the very beginning of all of this, that eventually we'd be seeing Iran, not just proxies, but coming into center stage as, you know, a focal point, and that we are moving around to that. But does this tie in to a need to finally, you know, take out Iran once and for all? You've got Wesley Clark's list. I don't know. But there's definitely some, I'll just say it, sinister reason that protesters are being obviously bussed into campuses, fed lines, you know, from the river to the sea, you know, things that are calculatedly anti-Semitic that do not seem to spring from any considered evaluation of the history or the players. It's just that these are your lines. This is what they're being told to say.
Yeah.
And they're being used, but why?
Yeah, they are being used. And I don't know if it's to kind of, here's a crazy twist on it. I don't even know. I'm just kind of grasping at things here. But you've got things like this that are going on in Tel Aviv. Again, you've got the protests that are back up again to get Netanyahu out.
Yes. So,
and he's out today saying they're going to invade Rafah or whatever. And what better way to steam that up is to have that on the other end is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That is a good guess. I mean, all the way around, there's so much going on that he's not popular. He hasn't been. They want him out. He's clearly at this point only still there because of a war that he insists has to be carried out.
So I honestly don't know. I don't know what his I don't think if he doesn't have a war, he's done. His whole cabinet's finished, right? There's no way that he can politically be saved at that point if there's no conflict.
No, I think I think we're going to see this continue. I've thought from the beginning that this was the opportunity to finish off the list?
Well, we're coming up on the final about 10 minutes here. Do you have any final points that you would like to bring up? Do you want to talk about some of what you're doing with your podcast, what you've got coming up with that? Or do you have any final topics you want to cover before you get away, before we get into that?
Well, I appreciate you bringing that little film clip to my attention and letting me know about it. I think it's good. I think that's kind of a required viewing of Alan and his dissecting of culture and how it's shaped. So that's good. And there's a lot of places that you could go. One thing I think I'll mention, that if people want supplemental viewing, and I'm going to give a parental guidance warning here, but there's a documentary that was done by the CBC in Canada entitled Legendary Sin Cities. And it's a wink, wink, aren't we naughty? Because it's obviously the producers who did this felt that they were taking the approach of sexual freedom and sexual expression. But what you see there in these sin cities, Berlin and Paris and Shanghai, is interwar degradation of culture. And again, in the OnlyFans type scenario, very, very poor people, desperate people who don't see a future, are making a living in this way. And I see real parallels to where we are right now, because you've got people like Elon Musk talking about universal basic income. We're hearing the drumbeat of artificial intelligence and how that is going to take away jobs, and robotics and how that is going to take away jobs. And all in all, I think that it's important to distract younger people so that they don't even stop and think that they don't really have much of a future. And then supply them with this very degraded way in which they can participate and have a future. So it's very sad, but I do think that we lived through a war the last 4 years, and yeah, what we're seeing is fallout.
I also think that I don't think we're at the fallout stage yet. Just my opinion. That's all. I think that we're going to see a spin up of a larger kinetic war on a global stage, not just something isolated. I think we're going to see a larger escalation of things. And I think we're going to have a major change. Whatever changes we see now, I think that's going to be increased tenfold.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I would agree with that. Now, what is going on that people can check out is that this week there are two new Tragedy and Hope Book Club videos. One of them is done and up, and that one is entitled Oh What a Lovely War. That's about World War One, conversation with Jared, and another one that won't be up until the end of the week on the Versailles Treaty. And then I've launched another listener supplied series. I just finished The Controllers and finished up with Margaret Sanger of Eugenics, Planned Parenthood, all of that. She was the last of The Controllers, and I launched The Authors. And the first one from the author series was George Orwell. So that was a good one that went up, and that's a listener supplied video. And that'll be up on all of the channels that you can check out. And there's always something. I mean, definitely the focus always has been and always will be Alan Watt in as many different ways and packages as we can think of to keep him out there in excerpt form, and the reduxes that go up on Sunday, and then the real history that I'm doing. And they're, you know, every time I do a real history, Johnny, I always think, well, that's the best conversation I've had. And then I have the next one. I go, oh, that's the best conversation. Yeah.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoy it. It's just so interesting to me to hear people's perspective. And I'm sure you have the same response with what you're doing, too.
I do. And I was going to say, people have no idea how therapeutic this is to be able to sit down and actually discuss things and not just sit there and have to reflect on your own thoughts after reading, for example, Tragedy and Hope. I read that before, long before we started doing podcasting, and I had no one to discuss it with. It was something that I had to kind of just take on my own. And I really wish that at the time that I would have been able to do what I'm doing now and go through it and review it, like kind of like what you're doing. I wish I would have been able to do that. But now I just don't have the time. I'm so busy now, I don't have the time.
Yes. Yeah. But you know, you just reminded me too that you just did your first podcast with Neil Foster that I've been doing the monthly podcast with. Yeah. And I think that what we are doing, the collective we here, is we're creating our own ways of communicating, building upon a network, I guess you could say, or
we're creating our own intelligence network is what we're doing. Is that it? Well, look at what we have as a intelligence now. Yes. If you don't have one that's reliable, build your own.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. But indeed, I think that this broadening the conversation, you know, people used to write 20 years ago, 15 years ago, people would write to Alan and say, I don't have anybody to talk to. Nobody in my family understands anything. I try and then I get shut down. They don't want to hear it. And advice that Alan often gave was for people to learn to live inside their own heads. And I really do think that it is a relief for us, many of us who have been living inside our own heads for a long, long time, to be able to have real conversations with other people.
What is going on with your latest podcast and what do you have coming up?
Well, the latest podcast, the one that I put out last week, I just had great fun talking to Henrique in Brazil, and we made comparisons between what happened with the Capitol in the U.S. on January 6th, and 2 years later, like they had a script, the same thing happened in Brazil. And that was kind of interesting because I hadn't paid attention to it. And the whole conversation, he referred to Brazil as Sodom and Gomorrah, and it was a very educational conversation for me. And what I'm posting tomorrow is a conversation that I did with Mark up in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. And he is a good friend of mine, was a good friend of mine and Alan's, and somebody that I've known for years. And it's always fun to talk to him. And we covered some very interesting things. And if you want to talk about bread and circuses and a little bit about even what Alan touched on there in that video, we got into sports and the role of how sports occupies the minds of men. And
it does.
Alan talked about that. You know, men, they need something to fight for. That's part of the genetic makeup. And that's not a put down. That's just what it is to be a man, is you got to fight and defend something. And now what you're fighting and defending is a sports franchise. So
bread and circuses. I've always argued that football, American football, is modern day gladiatorial arenas. That's what it is. That's all it is. The games never end.
No.
That will do it for us for today. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'll see you back in 2 weeks.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Pleasure's all mine. I love these conversations, and the listeners love them too.
Good.
It's always good when you come on. Everybody appreciates that. So keep coming back. That is Melissa from CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com. I encourage all of our listeners to get over there and take a look at the treasure trove of information where she maintains the life-collected works of the late, great Alan Watt. And her podcast is Real History with Melissa. That is available everywhere you get your podcasts. Melissa, it's been a pleasure. I will see you in 2 weeks. Thank you for being here today. Thank you to all of the listeners. God bless everyone and have a great evening.